Okay, so last year, I go to the park with my little boy, right? He's 7. He's a good boy. I tell him that daddy's gonna play a little basketball, and I walk over to the court. There's a few fellas there, 18, 19, 20 years old. They see me coming, and the one guy, he looks me up and down, and he says, "Ah, sir, we play rough out here." I tell him, "Shut up. Let's ball." And we do. And I'm juking him. I'm juking him. Bam! 2 points. Make it, take it, baby. Bam! Count it. Again. Pow! We play rough out here. I shove one guy in the back of his head before taking it to the hole. Who's playing rough now, fellas? I look over at my little boy. He's watching me intently. I give him a little wink. Two of the big fellas start running at me as I wag my finger at them from way behind the 3-point line. And right before the big fellas collapse on me, I jump. Up, release, big arc, the ball soars, spins, 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 spins. Nothing but net. Too bad! I raise my arms in triumph, walk off the court. My little boy runs over. He looks at me with such admiration and pride, real pride. He says, "Daddy, why didn't you join the NBA? "Well, I was gonna, but your mama said I wouldn't like all that nasty stadium food." He nods in understanding. Fast forward 1 year. About a week ago, same park, I'm playing basketball with my boy. He shoots, and the ball gets lodged between the rim and the backboard. Stuck.
"Dad, jump up there and knock that ball down."
I look up, and I know that me jumping up 10 feet in the air and knocking the ball down, that's not going to happen. I can't do that. And the boy, he senses my hesitation, and I can see his admiration, his confidence, his surety leaking away, and I cannot have that. So, I back up a few steps. A few steps more. Maybe if I build up a head of steam, I can...
"Hurry up, Dad, get the ball, so we can play."
I start running, faster, faster. I get ready, and I run right past the backboard.
"Son, this isn't teaching you anything. If I just jump up there, huh?
How would you get the ball if Daddy wasn't here?" He thinks about it.
"With a stick? Well, go find one."
He does and manages to pry the ball loose all by himself. We play. We have a great time. And for a few more weeks, days, hours, maybe, before he finds me out, I get to be that guy. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, we proudly present Rose-Colored Glasses. Amazing stories from real people who see the world a little bit better than it is. My name is Glenn Washington. Please don't retire my jersey just yet, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now then, who doesn't get swept up by a good story? It's the best way to see the world, especially if you're surrounded by good friends, good music, and that odd neighbor who can spin a tale like no one else. Snap Judgment.
Julian's a 70-year-old fella that, I don't like to use the word hippie, but he'll tell you that's what he is. Not to mention that he walks our neighborhood barefooted. Anytime you see bare feet on the road, you know Julian's walking around. Frequently, we would have what we called a neighborhood happy hour. We called it the Piney Wood Gathering, because everybody down there happens to have planted pine trees either on their property or in their vicinity.
Most Friday nights, Rodney and Julian and some of their neighbors would build a large bonfire, blast some good old Southern rock and roll music, grab ice-cold beers, and sit back as the sun dropped behind those pine trees. It was a sweet escape from the long work week. And if you hung around long enough, you were bound to hear Julian's crazy story.
When he lived in Culebra, Puerto Rico, and lived on a turtle preservation with his now ex-wife. Of course, some of the comments were, oh gosh, here we go again. My wife, her and Kelly, our neighbor, could hear them both saying, how many times are we going to hear this story?
It was a story that always started off the same way. One day, while Julian was walking along the beach scouting for leatherback turtles, he came upon a mysterious duffel bag
that was floating in the shallows. He tells it as, wow, I thought I found some pot, because apparently he couldn't find any pot to smoke when he lived in Culebra, and he thought he had struck it rich. So he took the duffel bag, and he took it in his little car, and he drove it home, proceeded to open it, and discovered that it was cocaine in kilogram form. He said there was about 16 or more packets wrapped in plastic and waterproof tape. He then buried the cocaine near his house. According to Julian, it had been there ever since, and as far as he knew, it was still there. But I'd heard that story at least four different times, but I never thought any more of it. We all joked about it and said, too bad you didn't bring it home and sell it.
Julian told that story so many times, it became larger than life. All the neighbors had heard it, so had their kids and their kids' friends. And then one day, this guy who worked for Rodney, Andy, introduced him to his roommate, Danny.
I'll never forget his words. His first words to me were, hey man, I can help you with that cocaine you've got in Puerto Rico. It caught me off guard, and it immediately had Andy get in the truck, and we left, and I asked Andy, what in the world was that all about? And, you know, Andy said, well, he's heard the story. He's been asking me about it, and he wanted to talk to you about it. My response to him was, you know, it's just a story.
It was just a story, of course. But for the first time, Rodney gave it a second thought. He ran his own construction business, and from that day on, Danny became a regular fixture at his office, chatting Rodney up about work. And Danny always brought the conversation back to that buried stash in Puerto Rico.
He had a friend in Tampa by the name of El Negro, who was a big-time drug dealer, and that it would be real easy if I went to Puerto Rico and found it. He had somebody that could bring it back. And the only thing I would have to do is find out where it's at, tell him where it's at, and he would bring me half of the money. And he had estimated the value of the stash at over $1 million.
Rodney was in his 50s. He was married with kids. He knew better than anyone that nothing comes easy. But Danny kept insisting that all Rodney had to do was point him to the buried treasure. That's it. Danny and his people would take care of the rest.
Every time he came and talked to me, it sounded sweeter and sweeter. So here I'm thinking, wow, he's got a guy, he'll take it, he'll sell it, he'll bring me a half a million, I can take that half a million and split it with Julian, since it was Julian that had buried it and knew where it was. Back at the time, it sounded like it would probably put an end to most of my financial needs. In 2008, I think I reduced my company from 80 people to down to about 6. We were paying the bills, but there were times I went without a paycheck, you know, just to make sure the other people in the company got their paychecks. It was in June that he finally told me that El Negro in Tampa had a pilot that flew things in for him from South America, and the fellow was Puerto Rican. He wanted me to meet this fellow. I really wanted to see what a real live drug smuggler looked like that owned their own airplane, because I've seen it on TV, but never really saw one in person. I want to put my eyes on this guy, see if he even shows up, see how accurate Danny was in what he said. And so I thought, fine, set it up.
The meet was at a little Mexican restaurant in St. Augustine. When Rodney got there, Danny was sitting with a man in a suit by the name of Carlos Rodriguez.
Carlos Private Air was the name of his company. And he had his pilot with him. He asked me if I wanted a drink, and I ordered one margarita.
They quickly got down to business. And this guy, Carlos, offered to fly to Puerto Rico, get the stash, and drop it off in Florida.
He said, let's just assume there's 26 bricks there. He says, my fee would be 4 bricks, and the rest will be delivered. Who's to say you don't go down there and get it and I never see you again? And, you know, of course, he told me that he's got many clients that continue to do business with him because he doesn't do business that way.
He tried to be a little bit on the cocky side, but I'm a big guy. 5'10", 300 pounds. I'm a little overweight, but I'm solid as a rock.
Only when they started telling me how easy they could get rid of it, how successful they had been on trips down there before, did it make it sound to me like, well, my exposure is very limited. All I've got to basically do is verify it's there and give them a map. And looking at the guy, dressed perfect. High-dollar slacks, high-dollar shoes, drank the best whiskey he could buy. That's when I became interested. When I left that meeting, he really had me fired up and excited that this could happen.
Rodney decided now was the time to bring the plan to Julian. The next day, he knocked on his door and told him everything about Danny's hookups, about the low risk, and about cashing in $500,000.
He was totally fascinated and excited about the whole idea. I even invited him to come with me, and he said, no, I'm not going back down there because if my ex-wife finds out I'm there, it'll be nothing but trouble. Julian and I sat down at a laptop computer on his front porch, and we pulled up a Google map, and he basically circled where he buried it adjacent to this cistern and, you know, gave me a pretty good idea where it should be. That's when I booked a flight to Culebra from Orlando just to see if this is real.
And like that, Rodney entered the story. There was no going back. But he wanted to keep his wife out of it. So he told her he was going fishing for the weekend with some friends.
I have a business partner that I didn't even share this information with. Nobody was to know anything. I mean, I just, you know, you don't ever tell your right hand what your left hand's doing, what I've always been told in business. And I tried to maintain that.
Rodney did not want to make the trip alone. So he took Andy with him, the one person who knew all about Danny and his proposition. They made the 3-hour flight to Puerto Rico, checked into their hotel. They bought a shovel, and that night, they drove down a long, winding road to the wildlife refuge where Julian's house used to be.
And it was pitch black, and, you know, we were trying to be quiet, you know, not make any noise. We didn't want anybody to know what we were doing. The only illegal thing at that time was me thinking about it. There was nothing illegal about what I was doing, and that made me feel better about the reason I was there. If you looked inside the cistern, that pipe was like only 6 inches down from the grade, from the ground level. So we thought we could scrape around, kick around, and get down, at least find the pipe and track the pipe to the end. But when we kicked around after about 10 minutes of not even getting an inch into this rocky ground, I mean, it was coral. That was it. Forget it. You'd have to have a backhoe come in here and dig it up, or you'd have to have a pick and a shovel, and everybody and their brother's going to see you in here digging during the day. When I left Culebra, I knew if I ever came back, it wouldn't be to look for that. It would be to go to the resort where I stayed and eat another 4-pound lobster for $35. Carlos Rodriguez, when he called me, I said, man, forget it. I'm done. It's going to remain a story.
But over the next 3 weeks, Carlos kept blowing up Rodney's phone, leaving messages, insisting that they meet up again. Danny stopped by his office day after day with the same plea. Until finally one day, Rodney gave in.
I told him he was had turned out to be a real pain in the way he couldn't take no for an answer. I gave him the Google map, and I had done a sketch for him showing where the pipe came out of the cistern and basically just penciled in showing him it should be somewhere right in here, you know, made an X on the spot. And that's all I gave him, those two pieces of paper. I thought, you know, at least he won't be pestering me anymore. This will be the end of it. Following week, I'm sitting at my office and I get an email from him, and it's a picture of excavated cocaine. It was a flash picture. There was nobody in the picture, but it looked like I could see ground behind it, like it had come out of the ground. And the color of it was black and some white. I know cocaine's supposed to be white just because I've seen it before. So right at that point, I got excited. I said, this guy's for real.
Right away, Rodney phoned Julian, telling him that his story was checking out, and it looked like they'd be getting paid in no time.
I didn't even sleep that night, Nancy. When I went to bed Wednesday night, I did not sleep at all. I was, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to spend this? How are you going to hide it? You know, what are you going to do with it?
2 days later, Rodney agreed to meet with Carlos in Jacksonville, where Carlos would give him the drop so he could pass it on to Danny, who would pass it on to El Negro, that drug dealer down in Tampa.
First, he wanted me to meet him at some golf resort, and then he called me on my way over there to tell me to meet him at the Gander Mountain. I was in a daze the whole way. I don't even remember half of that day because I was on cloud nine. Him telling me if I didn't get there within 20 minutes, he was leaving. So I pulled up to Gander Mountain. When I got out, I looked around. Of course I did. I don't want anybody to see me doing something like this. And there was nobody in the vicinity. He said, listen, I want to be a few minutes checking out. Here's my key. Pointed out to the parking lot where his car was. He said, go out there and open up the trunk and I'll be right out. So I went out, opened the trunk, and as soon as I opened it, there's a duffel bag, like a big sports bag, and it was unzipped. It looked like what I imagined it to look like. They were bricks in black, wrapped in black. When I swing around to put it in my car, I look down and there's lasers all over my chest. There was probably 16 agents with laser rifles. They had their guns drawn on me and told me to get on the ground. I hope this is a dream. I can't believe this just happened. I'm through. I'm going to prison. Every thought you could possibly imagine went through my head. In fact, before they could tell me to hit the ground, I was on the ground. I've always learned you don't point a gun at somebody. And here they're all pointing at me, and I'm thinking, God, one of these 15 people doesn't accidentally squeeze that trigger. They handcuffed me, put me in the back of a squad car. First thing I thought of was my family, you know, my wife and my child. What's going to happen now? That's when I realized what it was all about.
So Carlos Rodriguez, from Carlos Private Air, was actually a federal agent, and Danny was his informant. Danny was arrested months before for having over 100 OxyContin pills. He was looking at 15 years in prison. But then he told the cops a story he'd heard through the grapevine about a guy who buried a large stash of cocaine in Puerto Rico. He told the cops that in exchange for his freedom, he could find the guy that would lead them to it. And the cops, just like everyone else before them, bought the story. They wired Danny up with a mic and had him go after Rodney Hayden.
My wife gets a call from the court system that I've been arrested, and she's frantic. I think it was about 6 o'clock in the evening. And when they told her what I was arrested for, she automatically put two and two together. As soon as she hung up with the court system, who's driving up my driveway? Here comes Julian, because he thought Rodney would be home by now. So she turned and told Julian, get the hell off of my property, you SOB, blah, blah, blah. And poor old Julian wasn't expecting it.
At trial, Rodney's attorney accused the government of entrapment. He argued Rodney would never have gone hunting for that cocaine were it not for the government's help. At the end of the day, the jury found Rodney guilty of attempted possession.
I'll be the first to tell you that what I did was dumb. just did something as stupid could be by even getting involved or interested in this whole thing.
He was now looking at 10 years in a cell block. But at sentencing, the judge took pity on him.
He says, I know, and the government knows this is not a drug dealer you're dealing with here. If Mr. Hyden would have found it, I don't think he knew what to do with it.
The judge sentenced Rodney to 60 days in prison and 5 years of community service, basically a slap on the wrist. But Rodney doesn't think he got lucky at all.
I mean, I'm on tape telling them that I wasn't interested anymore and forget it. And then they kept pursuing it for two more months. Was I interested? Yeah. Was I wrong? Yep, I sure was. Will I do it again? Nope. Will I ever trust anybody again that I don't know when they come talking to me about something like this? Absolutely not.
Does Julian still tell the story?
I don't know. I haven't been to any more happy hours. We kind of quit having them after all this happened. It kind of put a damper on the whole neighborhood. Julian literally, I think he came up to the house and he started to apologize to me and started to cry. He felt really bad that I had gone through what I'd gone through, and he felt like it was his fault. And I told him, Julian, you don't need to feel bad for anything.
Right. The story got too real.
Absolutely. But I know now, if I catch myself thinking about anything that's not the way it should be, I slap myself on the face and say, wake up.
Thank you, Rodney, for sharing your story with Snap. That story is created as part of a collaboration from Snap Judgment and GQ Magazine. The original sound design was done by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Nancy Lopez, along with Daniel Riley, who first reported Rodney's story for GQ. You can find a link to Daniel's original article, The Great Cocaine Treasure Hunt, at GQ.com. When Snap Judgment, the Rose-Colored Glasses episode continues, one lucky young man gets the best job in the world and the end of everything you've ever known. For real. When Snap Judgment, the Rose Colored Glasses episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Rose Colored Glasses episode. Today, everyone wants the dream job. But it always goes to someone else. That is the rule. But what happens when that someone else is you?
This story starts back in the early 70s New York, when Merritt Riley was the Yankees' biggest 11-year-old fan.
I was hardcore.
Well, actually,
my mom and dad were big Yankee fans, so I really didn't have a choice, to tell you the truth. It was always extra special to be at a game, smelling the grass and smelling the popcorn. You know, always sought to get autographs and meet the players. But at the games, I'd be sitting there watching the bat boy retrieving foul balls, and I always wondered, how in God's name can I become that kid? I figured, you know, what the hell, I'll give it a shot, and I wrote a letter to Yankee Stadium. I didn't address it to anybody in particular, just hoping it would get a response.
And he did.
Pretty quickly.
From a bat boy named Joe.
Being the kid I was, I got the letter and I was so excited. It was written on Yankee letterhead stationery, and I was like, wow, this is it. I showed my mom and dad.
Bat boy Joe wrote back and said in order to join the bat boy club,
you had to have good grades, athletic ability, be 16 years old.
Merritt only met one of these requirements. He was a smarty pants.
Yeah.
But over the next 5 years, Merritt set his little mind and body to it, and bada bing, bada boom, Joe hooked him up, and Merritt became a Yankee bat boy. And even before he did any bat boy things, it changed his life.
I'm kind of making fun of myself here. When I was in high school, I was like a little nerdy kid, you know? I wasn't really, one of those popular kids, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, everybody wanted to be my friend. Kids that I thought would never talk to me because they were the cool kids, they were the jocks. You know, it's funny because a lot of those kids are friends still today. Best part of the job was being around players that, you know, a year or two before I was watching on TV and only dreaming that it would be like a dream to, you know, to meet these people. you know, and now I'm in the same locker room as them.
Being a bat boy is no easy work. Merritt shined all the players' cleats, did the laundry, and during practices, he'd shag fly balls. But his most important job was during the game.
During the game, you have one responsibility. Once that player that's at home plate hits the ball, whether it's a base hit or an out, your main and only responsibility is to get that bat and get it right back to the dugout.
Once in the dugout, all Merritt had to do was return the bat to the bat container, where the other bats hung out.
During the game, the Yankees were very, very strict about not being part of the game. You know, being invisible, really.
Now, Merritt was planning the rest of his life and career from his gig as a bat boy. If he did a good job, his plan was to become an umpire. Well, that was the hope, at least until July 24th, 1983, Yankee Stadium. Merritt's beloved Yankees were facing one of their biggest rivals, the Kansas City Royals.
It was a Sunday afternoon in July, and back then the Yanks and Kansas City, they saw each other a lot in the playoffs, and it was a packed house. You know, it was hot, it was a loud, you know, boisterous crowd.
Now, this game was extra special to Merritt, not because of the heated rivalry, but because of one player on the Royals, the superstar hitter George Brett.
For whatever reason, George Brett took a liking to me. Even though he was a superstar, he was like a regular guy. He'd, you know, clown around with everybody in the clubhouse. He'd always be breaking my chops about one thing or another. And, you know, kidding around, not mean. He had a nickname for me, and it was Spalding from Caddyshack.
Spalding Smales. Not the coolest nickname. Spalding from the movie Caddyshack is a spoiled brat infamous for picking his nose and eating it.
You know what? It wasn't like I liked the nickname. I just liked that he noticed me enough to have a nickname for me. You know, he made you feel important. That made me like him, you know? He definitely became my favorite.
Yankee fan listeners, don't worry about it. His allegiance is still with you.
Yeah. I mean, George Brett was one of those guys that I would secretly root for. As long as the Yankees would win the game, I was rooting for George Brett to do well. There weren't other players I could say that about that were not on the Yankees.
All right, so back to the game.
First inning.
Second, third, fourth.
The game didn't stand out for any reason.
Seventh
inning. Eighth inning. All right, here we are on the top of the ninth inning. The Yanks are up 4-3.
And it's a very close game with the Royals at bat with two outs and a runner on base.
You know, you figured the Yanks are going to win this game. You have the Yankee closer, Goose Gossage, who basically was lights out once they brought him in. But a player from Kansas City gets on base, and none other than my favorite player in baseball, George Brett. The crowd's on its feet. George Brett is known as the Yankee killer, but also well known as the hemorrhoid guy.
Back in the 1980 World Series, George had to leave a game early because hemorrhoid pain. Since then, every time he came up to bat, he was the butt of all jokes and jeers.
The crowd is going wild, jeering at George Brett because of a hemorrhoidal issue. I got a big conflict going on in my head. You know, I'm rooting for this guy, George Brett, to get the big hit. But at the same time, I want to see my favorite team win the game. So George Brett's at bat, and Goose Gossage leans in and delivers a pitch.
Uh-oh.
I could tell just from the sound of the ball hitting the bat, this thing was going to leave the ballpark. There was a very quick moment of silence, and then all of a sudden the place went crazy.
And now the Royals have the one-run lead.
So right away, I get up to home plate. I grab the bat. At the time, I know that I have to get that back to the dugout. But I said, you know what? I know I'll probably get in trouble, but I'm going to wait there. I'm going to wait there with the bat, and I want to high-five him when he comes around because he was such a good person to me. I wanted to show that I'm a Yankee fan, but I'm a George Brett fan. While I'm standing there at home plate waiting for George Brett to round the bases, the manager of the Yankees, Billy Martin, is on the top step of the dugout, the veins of his neck just like protruding from his neck because he was screaming for his catcher to check the bat, check the bat. Right after that, the catcher of the Yankees rips it out of my hand and he begins to inspect the bat for cork. When players cork their bats, it makes the ball travel further. It's cheating. The catcher checked it for cork and then saw that there was no cork, and he just dropped it on the ground right next to me. Gotta be honest, I didn't know what was going on. At this time, George Brett now crosses home plate and just went right to the dugout. I did not get to high-five him because now I was so caught up in what was going on. Right after that, the manager ends up at home plate screaming, I want that bat checked. I want it checked for pine tar.
What I'm talking about, Frank, is that he's got too much pine tar, and
The umpires are going to get together. George Brett looking around and wanting to know what's going on, and the umpires are going
pine
to
pine tar is a sticky substance
thing
that players put on their wooden bats. Basically, it helps them grip the bat, swing the bat, and hopefully hit a home run.
That pine tar up that far on the bat.
First time in a long, long time I've seen the umpires huddle this long and have a meeting over it.
Both they're feeling it, see, as if there's some sticky stuff around there.
But there is a limit to how much pine tar one can use. 18 inches from the tip of the handle, about the width of home plate.
The umpires take the bat, they lay it down against home plate to determine if the pine tar was too far up the handle of the bat.
Across home plate.
I've never seen this.
I never have either.
The umpires struggle to make a call, and that's because the pine tar rule, it's one of those obscure rules that's rarely enforced. And here, the crafty Yankee manager was waiting until the perfect moment to bring this tiny rule down on George's head.
I'm thinking, if I would have just picked up the bat and gotten it out of there instead of waiting at home to play for the high five, none of this would be happening.
That's Nick Bremigan with the
this
bat.
This is
right
going to be an interesting call.
Brett isn't sure whether he has a home run yet or not.
At that point, I stopped slinking away back towards the dugout, walking backwards. And the players were angry. And at one point, George Brett, who's now pacing up and down the dugout like a raging bull, he says, "All I know is that if they call me out, you're going to see four dead umpires.
Four dead umpires. Four dead umpires."
And almost right after that, almost immediately after that, the home plate umpire looks towards where the Kansas City Royals were and makes the out sign.
They might be going to call George Brett out.
Well, he is. He's out.
Yes, sir.
Brett is out. Look at this. Brett is out.
He's steaming mad.
George Brett just charges out of the dugout like a maniac. First couple buttons on his shirt were like open. You know, his hair was a disaster. You know.
Forcibly restrained from hitting plate umpire Tim McClellan.
Oh, it was crazy. It was crazy.
And the Yankees have won the ball game 4-3. Brett is called out for using an illegal bat.
Now I position myself inside the dugout, at which point the players from Kansas City are yelling at me. Why the hell didn't you get the bat? I was... you could edit this? I would my pants. 50,000 people and all these big baseball players. And I was scared. I'm not afraid to say that. I was scared.
At this point, all hell breaks loose.
Yankee Stadium security, the guys in suits and ties, they're out on the field. And one of them comes up behind the umpire and swipes the bat out of the umpire's hand and makes a beeline for the dugout, at which point a pitcher for the Kansas City Royals, Gaylord Perry, sneaks up behind the Yankee Stadium security and swipes the bat out of his hand.
Well, a Yankee security person and one of the umpires quickly are chasing whoever has the bat. Jose Martinez is holding Brett. Bobby, I've never seen this in my life.
It was something out of a movie. It really was. It kept getting worse for me. It was like a bad nightmare. It kept getting worse.
The game ends. Yankee fans celebrate as they leave the stadium, while the Royal fans are still stunned.
The players are gone. The umpires are gone. The whole swarm of people is gone. I'm in the dugout by myself. One of the clubhouse managers comes down and says, "You don't want to go up into that locker room right now. The Kansas City Royals don't want to see you. They're pissed off at you."
So Merritt begins his post-game duties, knocking the mud out of spikes, cleaning up the Yankee locker room.
At that point, I thought it was the end of the world. This is the biggest thing ever that's happened to me. The manager of the clubhouse, where the Royals were, came down and said, "Look, it's safe to go back down to the locker room. The guys that were angry are gone, so come on down." All I could tell you was I was real nervous. I entered the locker room very, very timidly, and I opened the door to the locker room. On the left-hand side is a swarm of reporters.
And guess who's in the center of this swarm? You guessed it. Superstar George Brett.
The one guy I don't want to see, and he's one of the only ones left. So I try to make my way towards the back of the locker room. I figured he wouldn't see me because there were so many reporters around him. And I go walking through, and, you know, you couldn't have planned it any better. The reporters move out of the way, and all of a sudden he locks eyes with me. And I'm thinking, holy, you got to be kidding. I thought I was dead. Yeah, I figured my heart was broken already. So he's like, "Spalding." And I stopped dead in my tracks. And I didn't expect that at all, that he would be in the mood where he's calling me by my nickname, you know? And I was like, yeah. And he looks at me, he says, why didn't you get the bat? And I'm like, holy Christ, what do I say? What do I say? You know, I'm speaking to a Major League Baseball player. I'm 17, 16, 17 years old. And before I could answer, he just started laughing. He said, I'm only kidding around with you. He goes, don't worry about it. And then he said, but you do owe me. And I remember saying, as clear as day, whatever you want, whatever you need. So he says to me, do you want me to tell you what he says to me? He says to me, the next time I'm back here in New York City, he goes, you're going to get me laid. And I said to him, you want me to get you laid? And I started laughing, you know, and he laughed, and that was pretty much it.
After the Pine Tar game, people called George Brett a cheater for using a special bat. But George, he got the last laugh. Eventually, the Pine Tar ruling was overturned, George got his home run back, and the Royals won the game. Oh, and remember the hemorrhoids nickname? That was now behind him.
As a result of the Pine Tar game, that nickname was forever gone. People don't even know about it, really. I know this whole incident could be blamed on my hero worship of George Brett. You know, any other player, I went up and retrieved bats probably thousands of times. The one time I didn't do it, this baseball history was made.
He's out.
Yes, sir.
Brett is out. Look at this.
Steaming mad.
He is out. Bobby, I've never seen this in my life.
And still to this day, I still have not gotten that high five I was looking for.
Thank you, Merritt Riley, for sharing that story with The Snap. Merritt still considers himself the Yankees' biggest fan. And a big shout-out as well to Daniel Barbarisi from The Wall Street Journal for bringing us that story. We'll have a link to his story on our website, snapjudgment.org. Original sound design by Renzo Gorio, and that piece was produced by Davey Kim. When Snap continues, imagine a world of everything good but one thing bad. Snap Judgment, the rose-colored glasses episode returns in just a moment. Stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the rose-colored glasses episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, reality is not as it seems. And for our next story, it's not that it didn't happen, it's that it didn't happen yet. Snap Judgment.
They didn't believe us when we said the world was burning. We stood on the street corners and handed out flyers. No one took them. You think it's hot now, we yelled at the sidewalk crowds. It's going to get hotter. But no one paid us any notice. To them, we were just a bunch of crazy girls yelling about the end of days. And then it did get hot, just like we said it would. Everything dried, everything scorched. People started dying quickly. We predicted the end, but we couldn't stop it. That's when we went underground. The cave was deep in the earth, where it was cool and moist. We piled the door with rocks. We knew we were building our tomb, but it was worth it, if only for a bit more time. The air started to stale and thin. We drank almost all the water and scaled back. A palmful a day, then less, then less. One night, while I stared into the black of the cave, I listened to everyone's breathing. Some were awake, some were asleep. They were all breathing fast and shallow. Their throats were dry. I slowed my breath, one of mine for every two of theirs. Then three, then four. As a girl, my father told me about holy men and women who could slow their bodies to the brink of death. Their hearts beating slower and slower, their minds quieting, their breath lengthening endlessly. They stayed alive forever sometimes. That night, as I lengthened my breath and listened to my heartbeat slow, was the last time I was truly awake. My heartbeat, my breath, my life came to a halt. I could hear the cave around me, hear the girls cough and moan and sometimes cry out. But when the noises became too sad to hear, I found I could escape into the fog. I could stop hearing, stop feeling, stop thinking. When the girls started to fade for good, I pulled the fog over me for the last time. I dreamed. I dreamt about my mother, about the closet in my childhood bedroom. I dreamt about a girl I kissed once under an almond tree. I dreamt about a salamander I once found, crushed under a rock next to the stream by my mother's house. It seemed I would dream forever. Tapping is what jars me. Tapping, then clanging, then a large rumble. The sound is so loud, it tears the fog off of me. Did you ever stare right at the sun, right at it, until all you could see was the brightest, most painful white?
Hey. Hey, are you alive? Can you hear me? I think she's breathing.
What? Who?
Hey. Hey, are you okay? Can you hear me? Are you okay?
What happened?
Oh my God, you're alive. You must have been here a long time. I can see right through your skin. Do you have a name? Can you remember anything?
The world was very hot.
I thought no one survived the burning.
We were right. The world burned.
Yes. It's a lot to explain, but the world burned and then cooled. When the water came back, the plants started to grow, and the people who survived came back up from the pole.
How do you know?
I study it. Some of us still do. Can you stand?
No. She moves my body for the first time in a century. My arms and legs are limp. I can't lift my head. And so the woman calls more people over and tells them to lift me and to carry me outside. And then my life starts, all over again.
I think I waited my whole life to open the cave. My whole life to find her. And now that she's here, she's everything to me. I'm hers. She's mine. She gives me the answers I've been waiting so long to hear about what the world was like and who its people were. When we talk, we time travel. She talks about highways and cars and the sound of traffic at night. A constant distant rush about cities all concrete and metal with buildings so tall they blot out the sky and how she hated them. She told me about the beach of her childhood, cluttered with boats and swimmers, hotels and arcades just beyond the sand. She loved the beach's pebbled shores best. so I find River's smooth stones and slip them into her pockets. When she finds them, she tells me she's never felt stones so soft. This world is so new, she tells me, and the people are so different.
Everybody's young now. They just stay that way. My eyes crease in the corners, but yours don't. Why?
I tell her how young I was when they gave me the herb. Just old enough for teeth, just old enough to chew. It tasted like sugar and grass, and it left my mouth blue for days after I ate it. And after 2 decades of growing and aging, I stopped. Years pass, and we all stay the same. My cheeks never line, my bones don't brittle. They may, but we don't know when.
Will you die?
I don't think so.
Will I die?
We can't give you the herb. It only works if you take it as a child.
I don't want to die.
Don't say that. I don't want to think about that.
They say dying is lonely.
We don't say that anymore. We wander as much of the world as we can. The oceans have grown, the coasts have changed. Sometimes we find the dead rubble of cities pounded into ash and sand. We rarely encounter other people, but we're not lonely. After time, we can speak without words. I can see her sadness, her happiness, her impatience, her wonder in her hands, her arms, the slump of her back. And then one day, she finds a gray hair under her cap and shows it to me. I shrug it off, but my throat closes. I pluck her hair and throw it into the wind. But more appear, and she starts to slow and stiffen. As each year passes, her braids get more and more silver. And then one morning, I find her letting down her bun, and her hair spreads white across her shoulders. She runs her fingers through it, shakes her head. She tells me,
"It's time to go home.
We have more to see, we have more time."
No, you have more time.
I don't want this to end.
I don't want that either, but I've seen enough. This is your world, not mine. Let's go home. I want to see my cave again.
When we return to our homeland, we're met by a small crowd. They scoop her up onto their shoulders and bring her to the cave. We clear the rocks away, and in the middle of the dark, low room, we build a bed. Right in the spot where I first found her, asleep. She finds my eyes and smiles. And then she climbs in. And we watch as she falls asleep. We listen as she breathes one breath, then another, and then no more. I put my ear to her chest. I can almost hear the thud of her flesh and blood and bone. I feel her palm, and there's no warmth there. But there's no cold either. I tell him I want to stay. I want to be there when she wakes. But they shake their heads. She's gone, they tell me. She's not coming back.
That story, Snappers, comes to us from the brand new Sarah Awards audio fiction podcast, Serendipity. Katie Mingle was the voice of our sleeping girl. Original sound design by Leon Morimoto. It was written and produced by Eliza Smith and Mark Ristich. Our good friends Ann Hepperman and Martin Johnson make Serendipity out of Sarah Lawrence College. Subscribe to the Serendipity podcast today on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. It happened. make it happen again. The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you to another world whenever you want to go there. You can get it anytime, snappers. Let someone know. Subscribe today at snapjudgment.org. iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, all of that. Snap was produced by the team that never needs to wear rose-colored glasses because they see the world exactly as it is. Please put your hands together for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Joe Rosenberg, David Kim, Renzo Gorio, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, Matt Ducat, Jasmine Aguilera isn't going to take it anymore. Big thanks to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. WBEZ in Chicago is the place at WBEZ when you're in Chicago. This is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could go through a seismic shift in public media that changes the credits on even your favorite shows, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is, but this is WNYC.